So the first, our first speaker will be Professor Ingrid Mattson, who will be speaking on the Quran in the Sunni community.
All right, good morning. Assalamu alaikum. Happy to be here with all of you. Thanks, Imran, for inviting me, and I'm so happy to be here with Hina Azam today, old friend from Chicago from many days ago, so should be a good time. 15 minutes for a short, just a little morsel of the topic. So I begin. Many years ago, when I was living in Connecticut, a well-known Sunni traditionalist scholar and preacher came to my home for dinner. I placed dishes of rice and bread and bowls of salad and beef stew on the dining room table, buffet style. Everyone filled their plates and we sat together around the fire in the living room where we ate and chatted. After finishing his serving, the scholar stood up, held out his dish and said, "Hel min mazid?" Is there more? After all these years, I still remember his words because I immediately responded to them on so many levels. As the host of the dinner, as a fellow believer, and as a scholar of the Quran, who is particularly fascinated with the way Muslims engage with the Quran in all different situations. This phrase, "Hel min mazid," is of course from the Quran. Phrasing his request for another serving in the words of the Quran had the immediate effect of elevating the food, the meal, the gathering. More than anything else, the Quran brings holiness to our lives. Human beings are constantly pulled, as if by gravity, into a state of dull mindlessness, ghafla, as the Quran says. We are mostly clueless, like groggy teenagers bumping into walls as we try to get to the kitchen. The clues are there, says the Quran. Think, ponder, reflect, be aware. The ayat of the Quran, its signs, its clues, draw our attention to the fact that every part of creation is a wondrous sign of God. However, what was striking about the Sheikh's use of this particular Quranic phrase, "Hel min mazid," to request more food, is the jarring contrast between the context of the friendly dinner in which it was articulated and the context in which it occurs in the Quran. In Surah Qaf, Surah 50, verse 30, which says, "When on that day we shall say to the hellfire, 'Are you full?' And it will say, 'Is there any more?'" The pious scholar was citing the Quran, but the Quran here is giving voice to hellfire, ravenous for more iniquitous souls to consume. Does the Quranic context matter? What is the added value, as it were, in citing the Quran here? Was it performative to demonstrate his mastery of the text? Was it a joke, and should the Quran be used in that way? Was he shy to ask for more food, and instead of articulating his own desire, he was cloaking it in God's words? Or if each letter, each word of the Quran is God's word, then as much as we turn to it for guidance, we can also bring any part of it to any situation at any time in any way. Each and every bit is special. And so Muslims name their children not only after prophets and righteous people or to indicate a relationship of servitude to God, Abdullah or Amatullah, but also name their children Taha and Yasin, names made up by taking some of the mysterious letters that open a number of surahs of the Quran. And if these are names, why not Basal, a name given to an unfortunate Afghan girl I knew by taking a name out of the Quran, Basal meaning onion. On an episode of Little Mosque on the Prairie, a wonderful Canadian production, how many of you have seen it? It's available in the United States, at least on YouTube, which is a story about a Canadian prairie Muslim community, small town. There is a main character is the imam, the Canadian imam of the mosque named Omar. In one episode, which draws out the story of Omar's increasingly deepening relationship with a non-Muslim friend who isn't always a good influence, His friend gets him in trouble. In fact, both of them land in jail after some trouble. And the imam is very angry at his friend. So his friend turns to him and says, doesn't the Quran say, should old acquaintance be forgot? Ammar says, that is auld lang syne, not the Quran. But there's something in that, expecting that the Quran has every good value, every good sentiment, every good principle should be found in the Quran. It's not only something that Muslims expect, but non-Muslims expect of us as well. There's a famous statement reported from Ibn Abbas who said, if I lost my camel's hobbles, I would look for it in the Book of God. We look for everything in the Quran. But of course, the question is, when we do that, are we simply imposing ourselves upon the text? Or might we be even cheapening it at times? Quran says we created the human being and we know what his soul whispers to him, for we are closer to him than his jugular vein. In my book, The Story of the Quran, I relate an anecdote told to me by Reem Osman, a Syrian-American from the suburbs of Chicago, who, as a teenager, was certified in tajweed by the late great scholar of the Quran, Abu al-Hasan Muhyiddin al-Qurdi, who died in 2009 in Damascus. Certainly a mercy for him, since he did not have to witness the horror that would overtake his country soon afterwards. Reem described her meeting with Sheikh Qurdi as the final stage in the certification process. After having undergone extensive testing by the Sheikh's senior female disciple, Da'ad Ali al-Husseini, an accomplished scholar in her own right. On the day of the exam, Reem was brought to the waiting room where she sat with a dozen or so other young women who one by one approached a curtain behind which lay the physically frail but mentally acute scholar on a daybed. The Sheikh asked the women to recite from various sections of the Quran to affirm their mastery of recitation. Reem described her astonishment at witnessing one of the teenagers who was there with her. After successfully completing her exam, she pulled open the drapes and said, "Oh Sheikh, I just want to see you." When I heard this anecdote, I was struck by how it mirrors the Quranic description of Moses, who, having climbed Mount Sinai, says, "My Lord, show yourself to me so I can gaze upon you." It seemed eminently possible to me that having studied the Quran so extensively, this young woman's intense emotions were now expressed in the form of the sacred discourse she had internalized. We all long to be close to God. From Moses to George Harrison, "I really want to see you, Lord." I believe that the same longing prompted this girl to want to see the one who was for her, in a way, the penultimate source of the Quran. Because Sheikh Qurdi's isnad, his chain of transmission of the Quran, links his knowledge of the Quran directly to God. The Quran is the most charismatic presence in the Sunni community. All other claims of holiness are suspect and contingent. Despite the pervasiveness of textual renderings of the Quran from printed mushafs and smartphone apps, it is the words of the Quran spoken out, naming a child from it, invoking a Quranic phrase, or saying Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim before an action, with which most Muslims, ordinary Muslims, if we wanted to use a kind of classist term, have contact with the Quran. The Quran is still the soundscape of holy space and time. It is the pious phrase to decorate a speech. It provides the primary substance to khutbas and many religious talks. Now, most Muslim communities share this cultural sound and landscape. So what characterizes the Sunni community in particular in its relation to the Quran? There's a certain difficulty here for a Sunni because the privileged position of the majority is that we do not have to know that much about minority communities to exist. I guess I'm the white male in the room here today. We assume our normalcy and all other communities have particularities. As an adult convert to Islam, I had the fairly common experience that for some time I insisted I was just Muslim, and I refused to accept any sectarian identity whatsoever. I became a Muslim because the Quran, or to be more accurate, a translation of the last juz of the Quran, cracked open my heart so the light of God could illuminate it. Like the men and women of the first community to hear the Quran, the person of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, elucidated its message to me. I heard about the Prophet's character from Muslims, who I sought out to teach me Arabic, so I could read what I heard recited. But at first I wasn't even convinced that I had to become Muslim in the sense of embracing this religious identity and becoming part of this religious community. I'd left my childhood religious tradition years before. I'd quietly walked out of that room of religion and closed the door behind me. But my own reading of the Quran led me to the conclusion that I would have to make some lifestyle changes if I were not to deny what I now knew, that this was the word of God. But I knew it would be difficult to live as a Muslim. I didn't want this hassle in my life. As I was holding back on making a commitment to be a member of this religious community, I dreamed of the Prophet Muhammad. I saw him receiving revelations, finding it hard, almost painful. I woke up and thought, okay, it will not be easy to bring the Quran and all it means into my life, but the Prophet Muhammad will show me the way. For the Sunni Muslim, the Sunnah of the Prophet Muhammad is intertwined, inexorably linked with the Quran and shaping the community. For a Sunni Muslim, the Quran cannot be understood fully and truly without the Sunnah of the Prophet Muhammad. The big question is, how do we know the Sunnah? And for many Muslims, that became knowing Hadith. But of course, this has not always been the case. Imam Malik, the great scholar of Medina, whose Medinan school is the original school of law, believed that the Sunnah was best transmitted through the knowledge, through the practice of the community and the knowledge of pious people. Over time, textualism came to dominate traditional Sunni Islam and then was challenged by others, both from, you could say, the right and the left. And so at this point, the question is, which one of those or which of those groups represents Sunni Islam? If there is a Sunni Muslim community, it is vast, contradictory, and contentious, a nation of undefined borders and regular bickering over membership. That diversity and disputativeness define this community is a direct result of the fact that both the Sunnah and the Quran are texts. I think we could find one limit or border of the Sunni community, though, at the point where the existence of an interpretive gap is rejected. Imran began this conference citing Ali ibn Abi Talib's words to the Khawarij, that this Quran is merely a scripture between two covers. It does not speak. It is men who speak through it. For Sunnis, the interpretive move between words and their meaning must be justified according to evidence and a methodology that is ostensibly accessible to all rational Muslims who can understand the sources. But the belief that it is possible for the meaning of the Quran to be accessible to humanity as a whole, that, as the slogan says, there's no clergy in Islam, can lead the Sunni community to a radical egalitarianism that is disruptive and anti-intellectual. It can also create a vacuum of authority to be filled by other manifestations of power, imperial power, for example. Religious anarchy is reined in by the construction of a foundation of skills and knowledge that can only be acquired through disciplined and supervised study. And this, on the other hand, can lead to traditionalism that veers on clericism. The recognition of a core set of diverse, equally authentic interpretive methods and schools within Sunni Islam is an aspirationally ironic solution to the rejection of the imamate on one hand, although Sunni Muslims, I would say, especially traditionalist Sunni Muslims, love the imams and their person and the family of the Prophet, the Ahlul Bayt. And the need to establish parameters of orthodoxy or the appearance thereof on the other. The embrace of an ethical pluralism that does not descend into relativism or anarchism is ideally the result of the Sunni approach to the Quran. But choice and the proliferation of choices makes us anxious. As Barry Schwartz argues very clearly and demonstrates in his book, The Paradox of Choice, Why Less is More, that human beings become anxious when we have too many choices, and we seek false certainties or we seek ways to manage our choices. Sunnism, traditional Sunnism, managed this by denominationalism. The different schools of thought, the theological schools and the legal schools, were ways of offering choice within the proliferation of choice, of offering 15 minutes? Oh, total.
You're 15 minutes ahead.
I see, okay. Didn't understand that sign. So there's a lot of sense to denominationalism. It is a voluntary embrace of constraints in order to manage this diversity. But denominational identity can harden and lead to sectarianism. Scholars have different levels of charisma. There can be a competition for resources and power. And just setting an identity, just articulating an identity, requires or sets the expectation that there are differences. It creates mythologies of origin. So what is the balance? Well, it's difficult. It is not easy to bear the burden of the Quran. When the Prophet himself received revelation, he would sweat. The Quran is not supposed to be so easy. The Quran says, "We offered this trust to the heavens and the earth and the mountains, but they refused to bear it. We're wary of it. Then man picked it up. Truly, he is oppressive and ignorant." Oppressive, ignorant. This echoes the description of humanity by the angels in the creation story of Surah Baqarah. Why would you put in charge of the earth one who will corrupt it and commit bloodshed? God's response is, "I know what you do not." So there are no utopias here, just struggle and trusting in God to help us understand it all in the end. And to sum up, I would say there's a lot to say about ijma and about the idea of the community. But I would say, and maybe we could discuss this more in the question period, if you're interested, that I think we've moved from ijma to jama'ah, and I think that's a good thing. I think ijma'ah, which was always challenged, even within the Sunni community by scholars, of course, Ibn Taymiyyah launched a devastating critique of ijma'ah, of consensus as something that really did not have a strong methodological foundation. But what's to replace it? Traditionalism itself was characterized by patriarchy, by being too close to power and empire. So if we move from ijma'ah to jama'ah, and I think this is, although the traditionalists would not embrace this, I don't think, it's simply happening. Communities are interpreting the Quran. Communities in the sense of religious congregations, different cultures. They're receiving the Quran, and custom and cultural interpretations, a more diffused decision-making process, maybe one that really reflects the idea of negotiated understanding, is starting to characterize Sunnism in the best parts of it. And I think that's good. I think it also reflects the Quranic values, the fact that the Quran identifies terms like ma'ruf, what is considered to be fair or just or right. These terms, these Quranic terms that put some choice and the decision-making process back in the community is something that I think could help us. That I'll end. Thank you.
field your own questions. I think you have one from the panel here.
Do we want to take it from the audience first and then the panel, or are
sure.
we?
Yeah, okay. Maybe.
Or I don't know how we're.
Yes. I have a clarification question.
Yes.
I wonder if your comment is really intriguing about from Jamaat to Jamaat. I wonder if you could complexify a little bit your understanding of Jamaat and the problems, and then your understanding of your sense of Jamaat as a kind of solution. Mm-hmm. I know you began that, and
yeah.
you didn't have enough time, and I'd like you to.
Right. So in the theory of ijma is that if the community agrees on an interpretation, that it is correct. And it was the solution for Sunni Islam to the problem of uncertainty, of wanting to have a certain decision, at least for some points, for some issues of faith and doctrine and practice, and also a way to answer Shiism as Sunni and Shiism became sectarian identities. If the Shiites had the infallible imams, what did the Sunni community have? But what is consensus? Who are the people who are needed for consensus? How do you determine consensus? What are the qualifications for consensus? Is someone these are the questions that were asked right within the Sunni community, and Ibn Taymiyyah is, you know, very notable for saying there's no such thing. You know, the Ahlul Hadith saying there's no such thing as consensus. This is ridiculous. We still see it being invoked until today. As Professor Dr. Aminan Wadood knows very well, consensus has been invoked to say, you know, ijma has been invoked to say things like, well, women can't lead prayer. And so we go back to this question, well, who says? Who gets to be a scholar? And the construction of whose bona fides account for this consensus is something that is being more and more and more and more challenged. Rightly so, I would say. Now, so what's the alternative? The alternative is say, no, we're going to have a more democratic, more egalitarian, more open, more gender egalitarian consensus. To me, I just don't see the mechanism for that working very well, and I'm very concerned personally with the pastoral needs of Muslims. I'm really focused on the pastoral needs and what I see Muslims do and what they need in community. And it seems to me that what they need is to place emphasis on the community and to say that when you live in a community, that you agree upon certain mechanisms of decision making that you're going to follow. And an example would be something like how do we decide the beginning of Ramadan? So you have these claims, well, the scholars say this position, then you have the communities who are living in places, especially in places like America and Canada, where the average ordinary Muslim is really burdened, and I would say oppressed, by the fetishistic way that traditional scholars rely on traditionalist answers. It's oppressive to the ordinary Muslim who can express his or her needs very well, and I believe has a right to bring that in. And if we look at someone like, the analysis in law of people like Wa'al Halaq, of the decentralization of decision-making in pre-modern Sunni Islam, I think a return to something like that is the way to go.
Thank you. Can I give just information?
He'll be having given his talk.
Yeah, you'll
so
be
maybe.
Giving your talk. Did you have a question?
No question. Just some information about ijma.
Maybe. I think questions.
Yeah. Are there
on
any other questions?
These are very good questions. Thank you for the message. So my question is about some of the traditionalists will push back until a year. That if we move from the ijma to the jama'ah, it would lead to groups like ISIS, for example.
Mm-hmm.
we have your community, and we have a suitable understanding. We cannot say this guy is not engaging in proper scholarship of understanding Islam. Mm-hmm. So the consequences of that approach, I'd like you to just say something about
it. Right. So traditionalists have been yelling at violent extremists for centuries, saying, you don't understand, you don't understand, you don't understand Islam, you don't understand the Quran, you don't understand. That's not the solution. The solution to groups like ISIS is political. You know, there's people with all sorts of crazy views in every society. And the question is, are they, you know, to have the freedom to say those crazy views is one thing, but it's always every state, no matter what state structure that is, has limited that speech when it has led to or become moved into the area of physical action, of actually harming people with weapons and guns. So, I mean, the traditionalists say these things, but I don't see, I mean, for an ordinary, and I don't think you need scholars, in fact, to say these things are wrong. In fact, sometimes the scholars have the traditional scholars have the most difficult time justifying their argument that these things are wrong. So if you look at that the group of scholars' letter to ISIS, not interested, no, Sheikh Abdullah bin Bayah and all of that. I mean, frankly, the traditionalist position is a little bit problematic. To say that the traditionalists were the firmest opponents of the abolition of slavery. If we look at people like Yusuf al-Nabahani, a stalwart traditionalist scholar who opposed the abolition of slavery against the modernists because he couldn't accept any kind of view that the Quran moves us in the direction of moral progress or these kind of goals. So now, 200 years after that, the traditionalists have caught up to the modernist view. And I don't think, I don't place the modernists outside of Sunni Islam. I think, you know, Sunni Islam, this is why, you know, what is the, so what's interesting to me is the intuitive view of the ordinary Muslim has always been, and I hear it from ordinary, just nice, pious, good, ordinary Muslims all the time is, of course slavery is wrong. Like, of course this is wrong. Of course this is, that's their immediate belief. In the same way, you know, and we can't get too much into it now, but in the same way that I believe that, I mean, the first Muslims knew something about God and expected the Quran to affirm their belief, like Khawla bin Tha'laba, like Aisha when she was slandered, like Asma bint Umais when she expected the Quran to speak to men and women. You know, I mean, so many Muslims expected the Quran to stand up for things that were good. And you might say I'm veering into Mu'tazilism here, but I don't think you have to move that far. I think the Maturidi, you know, theological school can support that view. So the traditionalists, I mean, authority and power are two completely different things. So the traditionalists confuse their authority for power. Sometimes it's power. It can be in certain cultural or social contexts, it can be, but I don't see it working very well right now, frankly.
Yeah, are there any other questions? I have a quote from you. We look for everything in the Quran, but when we do that, are we imposing on the Quran or perhaps even cheapening it? Can you, I got the imposing. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on the cheapening?
Yeah, I think of when I look at, well, this struck me first when I heard from someone, a kind of, you know, secular Muslim who, not an atheist, someone who still respects sort of religious people and religion. But one time she told me, she wanted to come, she said, oh, I want to go with you one time to the mosque just during Ramadan. I feel like being with Muslims for Ramadan, right? And she said, my only problem is, I every time I hear the Quran recited, it makes me think of death. It makes me sad. And I'm like, what? And she said, because I just, that's where I hear it. When I was growing up, that's where I heard it all the time. It's just the Quran constantly being recited when people die and at graves. And that really hurt me, you know, as someone who loves the Quran, like to think about that the Quran being recited had this negative impact because of how it was done. And then I thought of how many times I've sat in, say, conferences or different things where they feel it's necessary for someone to get up and recite the Quran at the beginning. And I'm like, why? Like, what, does it really bring blessing here? Or has it become just like a box that needs to be checked off and other people are doing other things? And it in a way, I think we can cheapen the Quran when we just say, okay, we'll just bring it everywhere. Shall I sit down?
Thank you, Ingrid.
Okay.
We will.